ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff. Coming up, I'll bring you the details of the sale of one of Australia's largest contiguous sheep station in the northwest of the state.
Well, you'd have to say they're some of the largest sheep production holdings ever offered to the market. I mean, they're just extraordinary in terms of their scale.
And the ABC Four Corners program, their investigation into the food industry has reignited calls for tighter regulations for labour hire practices. I'll have more on that shortly. But as you will have heard in the news, the CSIRO's Australian Centre for Disease Preparedness has confirmed positive test results for H5 bird flu in samples from 23 wild seabirds since yesterday's update. They all involve greater crested terns from Southend and Robe on the Limestone Coast and at Harriet River, Seal Bay, Vivonne Bay and Dorchester's Bay in Kangaroo Island. And these were all previously reported as suspect detections, but they've now returned a positive result for the H5 bird flu. So that means there's now 81 confirmed positive H5 bird flu detections in South Australia. Another two suspect cases since yesterday's update as well. But crucially, there remains no H5 bird flu detections in poultry or other livestock, and the risk to human health from this bird flu outbreak remains low. But for more information on the bird flu response, there are some upcoming community forums starting tonight in Robe, and you can register for these at birdflu.sa.gov.au. Also, in some good news out of the government, the state government has announced that it will be extending funding for the financial counselling support services for drought-affected farmers. A total of $876,000 will go to Rural Business Support to extend its financial counselling services to businesses that have endured sustained hardship from the recent drought, and increased resourcing will be maintained with the Rural Financial Counselling Service delivered on by RBS on behalf of the state and federal governments. And the money for that's provided through the drought support package, $117 million package that the government put together. The Primary Industries Minister wasn't available to speak on the Country Hour today, or a spokesperson from Rural Business Support, but we are hoping to hear more on this on the Country Hour tomorrow. But in a topic that has been ticking along in paddocks and in shops for some time now, the Australian Fertiliser Services Association is calling for a Senate inquiry into the federal government's $7.5 billion fuel and fertiliser security facility, which was designed to protect Australia from the global disruptions like the conflict in the Middle East. Now, the facility provides price risk support for companies importing fertiliser in volatile markets, but has only been taken up by three importers, Incitec Pivot, CSBP and Summit. The chair of the Australian Fertiliser Services Association, Heath Bosley, explains how the underwriting affected the fertiliser businesses that weren't included.
So the government did step in. They were fairly late to the party, and approximately about 85% of Australia's urea tonnages were already committed by the time the government stepped in. And then the government came in and they went, here we go, and here's our chance to get some urea into Australia. So by the time they come in, there was only 14% of the urea market left. But given they were backing only a chosen few importers into Australia, and every other importer and then reseller had to wear some losses as this balance sheet from the government supported the importers where they didn't have the risk, and the risk was then carried by the other importers and then resellers.
What sort of commercial environment were you working in at that time?
So at that time, everyone, including importers in, but including the government, were indicating that high prices were, you know, well into post-winter into spring. And then also, as I mentioned before, that actually the availability of the urea was going to be the problem. So that made every reseller, and yes, lots of farmers jump on board and secure their nitrogen requirements to make sure it wasn't limiting to their crop yield for the season 26. So at that time, yep, we did as we were instructed, and then all of a sudden urea becomes available, but also at a cheaper rate. So it drastically drove the market down, which, as I said, importers and resellers carried that loss.
When you say it reduced, just can you give a sense of just how much the price of urea dropped by and over what time frame?
So urea traditionally, you know, year in, year out, it's probably $700 to $800 a tonne. Ballpark. Urea jumped to $1,400, $1,450, somewhere in there. And then once this golden handshake was awarded to a chosen few importers, urea dropped to $1,200 and then has considerably dropped since down to sort of mid-800s.
What is the price now?
Today, urea prices, I think it's about $840.
What has this meant for resellers who aren't among the three importers who were underwritten by the federal government?
Yeah, as we were encouraged to get out there and secure tonnes to make sure we had tonnes available, all of those tonnes, whether you had 1,000 tonnes or 10,000 tonnes, whatever your contract volume was, the mum and dad companies have had to carry that loss to what it's now being sold at. So, you know, these losses are, you know, $200 to $400 to $500 a tonne on, you know, 1,000 or 10,000 tonne volume, whatever size parcel you had contracted.
So
it adds up pretty quick.
Just how big a loss could these smaller operators be wearing now?
So within the AFSA network, there's approximately 90 members, and each one of them is either, some of them are fertiliser and ag chem resellers, but lots are solely fertiliser. And all of those people would have contracted volumes of 2,000 to 4,000 to 8,000 tonnes by $400 a tonne loss. So you're wiping millions of dollars off every mum and dad balance sheet out there in the reseller world for fertiliser.
Does this mean that people are walking away from urea they had intended to buy from these smaller fertiliser providers?
I've actually seen both sides of that. Some of the farming community realise that, you know, we need competition and they've got a really good relationship with the reseller, and they've either taken the higher price tonnes or worked out an agreement. But then I have heard and seen the converse of that, in that farmers have just been able to walk away from those contracted tonnes and then buy it in at whatever dollar figure lower than what they'd committed to earlier, which is, you know, as I said before, $200 to $400 cheaper per tonne.
And as you've said, could have been millions of dollars worth of losses across the smaller fertiliser providers. You have raised this with the government and other organisations as well. What has the response been in particular from the government?
So, yeah, we have raised this with them on a number of times. Initially, there was go away, nothing to see here sort of attitude, which has started to change. We're starting to get some traction amongst other government and people involved there. They're actually really seeing the impact that this has had on small business and on the farming reseller world and the importers into Australia, and the fear that this could lead to decreasing competition going forward. So we're starting to get some traction there, and we're heading to Canberra in a week's time with lots of senator meetings lined up and ready to pitch our approach that this could have been handled a lot better.
What is the outcome you're hoping for from your visit to Canberra?
At the moment, our outcome, we need to make sure that we know if this facility is ongoing, if they are going to only support the three importers into Australia, or are they looking to import everyone? And then on top of that, we need some sort of compensation to make sure that, you know, this is actually fair amongst every importer and every reseller rather than the golden handshake to a select few.
Do you see a Senate inquiry coming out of this?
Hopefully. I mean, everyone out there wants to see where this $7.5 billion for the fuel and fertiliser has actually been spent, and whether it was wise enough, and the impact on competition that particularly the fertiliser side has brought about.
Given this was government mandated, is there any opportunity for a class action as well?
The class action is definitely gaining momentum. There's lots of resellers here that are really hurt by this. obviously wiping millions of dollars off your balance sheet creates pain. And a lot of these people and family-owned businesses really want to see some sort of compensation. So hopefully we don't have to go down that path. But, yes, there's definitely loud murmurings out there that we need to do this to try and get some justification in the whole process, and then leading to possible compensation as well.
The government has said that the underwriting was actually available to anyone. Why didn't any other businesses take it up, do you think?
No, other importers definitely tried to get into the facility. It took forever. Some of them weren't even getting a phone call back or email replies for a long, long time, and I feel that's part of the problem. And then the government have jumped on now and tried to go back to them and say, oh, you know, you can hop on. But, yeah, quite too little too late. Generally, the fertiliser market is very well served. I'm not quite sure why the government now jump in. We haven't seen them in the past, but they haven't helped out in GFCs and COVID and any other time to get fertiliser into Australia. So I'm not sure why they just jumped in now.
Do you think there has been any effect on the crop? Do you think everyone was able to access the urea they needed, given this has ended up being quite a good winter for at least the south of the country?
That's actually quite interesting. So even in Incitec Pivot's shareholder statements, there's actually been more urea being brought into Australia this year than in previous years at the same date and time frame. So the market's actually done really well to get enough urea into Australia in the growth stage and in the months that we need it to satisfy the moisture that we've been lucky enough to have this year. So I think it's a fair proof that the free market in such that the fertiliser market has been for decades didn't really need this government interference, which has led to this hindrance to a lot of resellers' bottom line.
You mentioned other shocks to the system. There have been concerns that the fertiliser market works on a just-in-time model. Do you see that changing as a result of this?
The just-in-time model is actually, it's complicated in terms of, yes, we've got to get ships to the right place at the right time, but we just need to keep our overheads low and make sure that fertiliser's coming in and getting used in that time frame. So I probably don't see a massive change to that. What I'd like to see is actually more fertiliser manufactured in Australia, because then once it's in Australia, we can get it around the country via our freight network fairly easily, rather than having massive stockpiles of fertiliser waiting to be used. So I feel that's probably our best way forward.
Chair of the Australian Fertiliser Services Association, Heath Bosley from Pinneroo, speaking there, and the organisation will be having meetings in Canberra in a little over a week. We do have a response from a government spokesperson saying the Fuel and Fertiliser Security Facility was established to respond to significant market disruptions to global fertiliser supply chains as a result of the Middle East conflict. Participants were prioritised against a national interest test to meet the objectives of the facility. We continue to closely monitor the situation in the Middle East and the fuel and fertiliser outlook. And we will keep following this, as I said, with the approaches now to government for more involvement from the Australian Fertiliser Services Association. We've got a text here from Chris saying, don't forget about the farmers who had to wear the high costs. We can't pass any prices on. Thanks for your text there. You can also text in 0467 922783 is the number to text in on. It's 18 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
To property now, and Adelaide businessman Professor Khalil, or Charlie Shahin, has bought Australia's largest contiguous sheep station. The Jumbuck Northwest Pastoral Aggregation has been held for more than a century by the McLaughlin family and covers almost 1.3 million hectares. CEO of Elders Real Estate, Tom Russo, has the details.
We took to market an aggregation of three stations, and they're all contiguous, Commonwealth Hill, Mobella and Bulgunya, all situated in the Kingunya district, which is in the far northwest pastoral district in South Australia. So together, it's sort of a 1.29 million hectare aggregation of sheep country.
And who was the buyer of this massive tract of land?
So the aggregation has been acquired by a family office called AFO, which is Professor Charlie Shaheen's family office, which he runs with other family members, including his daughters. And they're sort of post the exit from the OTR business that the Shaheen family is very famous for. Charlie has been investing in a number of different assets across multiple asset classes, including a station up north in the Territory, a cattle station. Charlie actually has agriculture in his blood. He studied agronomy back in the day, and now he sees an opportunity to invest in the industry. And so he's establishing a portfolio of assets across cattle and sheep.
These were sheep stations that he has just bought. Do you know what his intentions are for the enterprises he hopes to run now on the properties?
Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely, it's sort of traditional merino country, and Charlie intends to continue to run it as a sheep station. I think we can probably see an enterprise change in terms of introducing perhaps some Dorpers into the production mix, but certainly including some merinos in the mix as well.
And this property has been sold by the McLaughlin family. They have been the stewards of the land for a long time. Can you tell me a little about the McLaughlins and what this sale is part of?
I must say, it is a privilege to work with families like the McLaughlin families. They're obviously been in the industry for multiple generations, and some of the things they've done, really, it's not too high to say that it's a folklore type stuff. And, you know, they've pegged out a lot of these properties and they've owned it from day one and developed it, which is extraordinary. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of blood, sweat and tears that goes into that. At a personal level, they're just beautiful people. They're terrific to work with. But like all families, there comes a point in time where, you know, succession planning needs to be done, and they have done it proactively, and they've worked through a process, which is great to see. You see a lot of other families who potentially leave it too late and don't plan it well, and it can become quite contentious. And so this has been really part of a very orderly, very well-planned succession process. They've divested a few stations now. I think we can see that's the end of that. And the group, as they have publicly announced, the group is now divided up between the siblings, and they'll continue to run individual assets themselves and get on with creating their own legacies.
How significant was the offering from the McLaughlins, including Rawlinna Sale Station on the West Australian South Australian border last year?
Oh, I mean, it's probably, well, you'd have to say they're some of the largest sheep production holdings ever offered to the market. I mean, they're just extraordinary in terms of their scale. So, you know, this asset alone, it was about 1.29 million hectares. So, you know, it's a big chunk of country. Obviously, it's pastoral country, so it needs to be large to run that level of productivity that you need to make it work. But it's, you know, it's extraordinary. I mean, I don't think you'll see an offering of that size in the market for quite some time. You know, Commonwealth Hill alone is about 980,000 hectares and can run a maximum rate of about 55,500 sheep, according to the lease. You know, Bulgunya, another 28,000. I guess I would say it is a holding of global significance in terms of the food and fibre supply chain that it plays in.
Is there any indication of how much was paid for the land?
Oh, no, look, we're not. That's all confidential, and we won't be providing any value details.
Just how much interest was there in this pastoral country?
Oh, look, it was really terrific to see the level of interest we received. And I think, if there's one thing I take out of this sale, it's that sophisticated investors, still have a very confident view on the outlook for the Australian fibre and food production. The level of growth in the middle class and the growing prosperity of the middle class globally is really driving a lot of demand for our product. And investing now to participate in the supply response is a really exciting opportunity. And we saw that in this process. You know, we saw corporate investors, both domestic and international, have a good look at this asset. We also saw really strong incumbent local pastoral families participate in the process and run the ruler over the assets. And so it was just great to see the level of confidence in the industry, both from institutional capital, but also incumbent family capital, really having a good crack at looking at the assets. I think it bodes well for the future.
And it was a relatively quick sale if it was put on the market in May. That seems quite short a time frame for this sort of property.
Yep, no, I think it was, and that's probably indicative of the motivation of the parties that looked at it, and also the way Charlie Sheehan does business. You know, he knows what he's looking for, and he acts quickly and decisively.
CEO of Elders Real Estate, Tom Russo, speaking there with the details on the sale of the three properties from Jumbuck Pastoral. And last year, the company sold Australia's largest sheep station, Rolina, on the West Australian South Australian border to Consolidated Pastoral Company as well. We'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now, where I'm joined by Tom Anderson. Good afternoon.
G'day, Cathy.
It was a chilly start again this morning in parts of South Australia. What were the temperatures?
Yeah, we had it was very much a tale of two states this morning. So we had Ceduna this morning had its coldest morning in 2 years. They got down to -1.6. A couple of stations in the southern parts of the northeast pastoral district also registering their coldest mornings for a couple of years as well, looking at temperatures about -2 or -3 there. But then at the same time, much of the southeast of the state was under a pretty thick cloud band. So we had stations in the Riverlands that didn't get any lower than 7 degrees overnight, where for the last couple of weeks they've been having frosty mornings. So, a little bit of variance across the state. But since then, we've seen a bit more of that cloud cover clear itself away, and it's a mostly sunny and fairly calm day across the state.
Right, so coming up, I know there's rain forecast for the weekend, but before we get there, is there much around?
No, so there'll be maybe a couple of showers on and off over the next few days for some very coastal areas, so probably mostly just the southeast coast and Kangaroo Island itself. It's more likely to have some frosty mornings for much of the agricultural area over the next couple of mornings. We're getting into a pretty settled working week, so frosty starts, but then we are seeing that sun come out and the maximum temperatures increasing through to Friday, where broadly across the state, we are seeing a lot of places expecting at least 20 degrees, if not a little bit warmer. Parts of the southeast may not get that warm, possibly only 16 for Roe, but then even Adelaide itself is looking to get to 20 degrees on Friday. Pretty settled working week. But as you said, we are expecting a decent amount of rainfall coming from Friday afternoon and evening from the west, and then across the state Saturday and Sunday.
And it seems like that system's going to linger as well. Is that looking likely?
Yeah, the system with a few little branches of cold fronts and troughs. We will see rainfall. We are expecting to see rainfall basically all weekend. So it'll kick off on a Friday, and then on Saturday we will see rainfall for very large swaths of the state. Maybe parts of the northeast will miss out on rainfall on the Saturday, but then we are seeing a little bit of a contraction to the eastern half of the state by Sunday. But much of the agricultural area, the southeast, and even parts of the northeast pastoral district will see that rainfall continuing on Sunday.
Are you expecting much rain with this system? Sorry, not much rain, much wind with this system.
Yes, we're probably going to see some pretty gusty showers and possibly thunderstorms with this system, particularly on Saturday. That's one to watch. Now, there's a bit of variance in the modelling and a bit of uncertainty of how strong that is, but all in all, it does seem like it's going to be a pretty gusty and wet system.
Great. Well, thanks so much for your time today. We'll get more details on that system as we get closer to the weekend. Thanks for your time.
Great. Thanks, Cathy.
Tom Anderson from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be mostly sunny but chilly with some areas of morning frost. Overnight, it's dropping to between 0 and 4 degrees with the daytime temperatures reaching about 17 to 20 degrees. The lower western will be partly cloudy with, again, some areas of morning frost, maybe a bit of fog in the northwest as well. Overnight, the temperatures are getting to 2 below 0 and 1 above 0. And daytime temperatures reaching about 16 degrees. It is 29 minutes past 12.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's great to have your company today. This is the Country Hour, and coming up, an ABC Four Corners investigation has reignited calls for tighter regulations of labour hire practices.
The things I was seeing was definitely not legal. I would be there from 7:30 in the morning to 5 p.m. And I would be paid $20 that day.
I'll have more on that. And would you snack on fly larvae? It's not a traditional protein source, but it is something we've talked about a little on this program, with there being black soldier fly larvae production in this state. So could it be a sustainable alternative to bulk up animal feed or even human food? I'll have more on that in the next half hour. But first, we'll get the latest in news headlines with Matt Coleman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, 81 birds have now tested positive for the deadly H5 strain of bird flu in SA, an increase of 23 in the past day. The greater crested terns were found on the Limestone Coast and Kangaroo Island, which are emerging as outbreak hotspots. A further 28 suspected cases have been sent to Victoria for final testing and confirmation. Port Lincoln show organisers say they're taking a precautionary approach by cancelling poultry showing at this weekend's event due to bird flu. The only positive case of bird flu in Port Lincoln was detected in a giant petrel on Proper Bay Road last week, not far from where the Port Lincoln show hosts its event. And fuel prices have spiked across South Australia, with remote communities paying the most. Unleaded petrol and diesel is above $3 a litre in some parts of the far north. The federal government's discount on the fuel excise came to an end on Sunday, adding 16 cents a litre to wholesale prices. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Matt. Well, as I was saying, $20 for a day's work and nappies handed out instead of toilet breaks. These are some of the stories being told by some of the agricultural industry's most vulnerable workers. Across Australia's horticulture industry, workers have been describing experiences of low pay, overcrowding and slum-like housing, labour hire contractors controlling where they lived and worked with little power to complain. They've been shared with ABC Four Corners during a lengthy investigation into worker exploitation in the food industry, both here in Australia and overseas, and this has reignited calls for tighter regulation of labour hire practices. Jin Lee spoke about his experience having worked on blueberry farms in Coffs Harbour.
The things I was seeing was definitely not legal. I would be there from 7:30 in the morning to 5 p.m. And I would be paid $20 that day. Some of us got diapers because they didn't provide bathroom breaks. We basically had to pay everything by ourselves out of pocket. Because they just wouldn't provide any equipment or anything for us. We were paying $150 for the accommodation a week.
What was the accommodation like?
It had 18 people crammed inside of that house. Each room had four beds, as they call them, and it was just mattresses that they took apart. So one room had children's bunk beds. So obviously not very comfortable for adults to sleep in. There were roaches everywhere. There were broken doors, broken windows, and the air conditioning unit was broken.
Jin Lee, one of the workers interviewed by Four Corners. The peak body for Australia's berry industry says growers often outsource employment to labour hire companies, but the lack of state and federal licensing means the industry is largely unregulated. Berries Australia CEO Rachel McKenzie spoke to Lauren Behane about the stories detailed in this week's Four Corners report.
It's always extremely distressing to hear those stories. And let's be clear, those kind of activities are very, very illegal. Berries Australia has been calling, and are on the record as calling, for a national labour hire licensing scheme for many years. And if we are unable to get a national labour hire licensing scheme, then New South Wales needs to fill the gap that they have and actually put in place in New South Wales. So labour hire licensing has dramatically cleaned up workforce practices in Queensland, and we recently met with the New South Wales Minister for Industrial Relations to actively progress this scheme, and it is urgent. New South Wales, unfortunately, is a black hole for dodgy labour hire companies. A Fair Work Ombudsman 2025 Horticulture Compliance Report found that 91% of infringements that they came across related to labour hire. And there are examples where many times the growers were paying the correct amount, but those funds were not being passed through to the employees.
The Four Corners report acknowledges that in some cases, growers don't know what's going on. In the absence of a national or a state labour hire licensing scheme, what can be done to address these issues?
Well, we strongly recommend to all of our members that they become part of the Fair Farms Initiative, which is a third-party auditing program for social compliance. And within that, and within the current legislation, there is a thing called accessorial liability, which is the requirement of the employing farm, like the host farm, to ensure that the labour hire company does meet its obligations. And we strongly recommend that growers put in place what we call a labour hire agreement. Unfortunately, you know, I think for many growers, they're extremely busy at, you know, for most of the year, they're very small businesses. And then, you know, at certain times of the year, they have to suddenly be employers of, you know, 150, 200 people. And Australia's workplace law is complex. So it's easy for them to outsource that obligation. And unfortunately, we are lifting the understanding of our members to ensure that they do know what their obligations are. But yes, that is a gap we are actively trying to work on, which is just making sure that our members understand that they have accessorial liability under the Act and that they should have a labour hire agreement in place.
Are you finding more growers are taking that advice on board?
It's difficult to say, but I think it's really important that we continue with our strong messaging around the importance to have a labour hire licensing agreement in place. But at the same time, the growers shouldn't have to be the policeman here. They should be able to trust that there is some sort of system that has oversight of these labour hire organisations so that the growers can then have faith that the organisation that they are bringing onto their farm is doing the right thing. I mean, we don't have to check the credentials of a plumber when they come and do work in our house. We assume that that is already looked after. And I think similarly, growers have that, you know, the same sort of assumption. However, there isn't anything in place and that's something that needs to be fixed.
So that would be fixed by a state or a national labour hire licensing scheme?
Well, I think the stats in Queensland tell the most compelling story. So in Queensland, prior to a labour hire licensing scheme being in place, the Moreton Bay region in Queensland, which is also a berry growing region, had very high non-compliance. When the Fair Work Ombudsman went back for this more recent 2025 horticulture compliance report, they found only 8% non-compliance, and it was all very minor kind of paperwork related stuff. So for me, this is not just about what I think, it's actually really clear in what has happened just over the border. We can see the difference. It is marked and statistically valid.
Do you feel as though this is something that the state government or potentially the federal government is taking seriously?
They seem to be taking it seriously, but until we actually have something in place, I'm not going to be overly confident because we have been asking for this for a long time. And we just need to see it put in place.
That was Berries Australia CEO Rachel McKenzie speaking there to Lauren Behane. And you can read more about that wider story by ABC Investigations on abc.net.au/rural. A federal inquiry into the hemp industry has revealed that policy settings from food to building standards need overhauling for the sector to grow. 14 recommendations were included in the Senate report tabled last week. Committee member Senator Richard Colbeck says the industry has great potential, but there are some hurdles to overcome.
Because of the nature of the industry and being relatively new in that sense, the recommendations cover a pretty broad range of elements, from how the government can assist with further research and development for future growth of the industry, how some of the product coming out of the industry can be supported with respect to their regulatory frameworks, and in some cases how the industry can help itself in some of the things that it needs to do in respect of, say, representation, but also development of further opportunities. So it's a pretty broad-ranging report. I'm pretty pleased with the outcome, and I just hope that it assists the industry in moving forward.
What are the primary areas that the report and recommendations focus on?
So there's a few regulatory things, and given the nature of hemp and its relationship with other hemp-based products, particularly marijuana, there's some pretty strict regulations that control the management of those sorts of products. And so how a grower or a manufacturer can properly utilise the whole plant has been one of the issues that's had to be dealt with. So working our way through some of those regulatory hurdles is one element of it. Then there's some of the products that come out of it, how they're recognised for utilisation in the broader economy. There's, again, some regulatory work that needs to be done there. For example, the building industry is a standards-based industry, but there aren't necessarily any standards that exist to support the utilisation of hemp products in the construction industry, such as how its fire ratings work and things of that nature, and how it might be recognised in the National Construction Code through standards. Those things need to be developed. That will support their uptake and utilisation in the industry. Then there's some things like measurement of carbon and how its carbon measurement can be dealt with and managed. That will assist with both construction and other elements of growing hemp. And then there's some things that you might not necessarily recognise. For example, utilisation or references to hemp on social media platforms often get the users of those removed from the social media platforms. And so that inhibits the capacity for producers of, say, food-based hemp products to advertise their product in some of their markets.
Changing legislation isn't a fast process. Which of the recommendations should be prioritised by the government?
Well, I think given that we're coming to the end of the cycle of R&D, I think that's important to look at the next cycle of research and development, but also the work that can be done, I think, at a cooperative level across the country with respect to harmonisation of some of the regulations nationally. I think that would make a real difference to the industry. That's work that can commence straight away, and it's a matter of willingness to take that up, and there's a number of recommendations that address that. And so having a nationally consistent framework to work in, I think, would make a real difference.
Would the committee agree that legislation has held back the potential of the hemp industry?
Look, I think there are certainly some areas where it has frustrated the industry, and as I said, there are connections and probably perceptions, sometimes false perceptions, in relation to the relationship with, say, marijuana, which is another variety of hemp, that have inhibited that. Even the process to enable the sale of hemp seed as a food product in Australia took a considerable period of time. Now that it's occurring, it's made an important move forward and change, positive change for the industry and its viability. But it's all of these things coming together that are important. There are some changes that are a bit delicate because of the relationship of the plant type and impact on other industries, such as the poppy industry in Tasmania, that have to be considered carefully. But the opportunity to export, which is currently difficult, I don't think is necessarily one that should be too hard to support through the process. So there's a number of things, but I think initially, some of the harmonisation processes would make a real difference to the way the industry operates within the country.
Tasmanian Liberal Senator Richard Colbeck speaking with Mackenzie Archer. It is 17 minutes to one.
What's really in the food we're eating?
A lot of the labels are not true.
A major Australian food investigation yields shocking results. Duped, a two-part special from Four Corners. Streaming now on ABC iView.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
When we talk about protein sources a lot on this program, there's sheep and cattle, even kangaroos, if you're getting a little more exotic, but would you snack on fly larvae? Well, it's not a traditional protein source. Research undertaken by Adelaide University has found black soldier fly larvae could be a sustainable alternative to bulk up animal feed or even human food. But is it really safe to consume? And what does it taste like? I can't say I have tasted it or that I'm really chomping at the bit to try it, but researcher with the Adelaide University, Sam Mallard, can explain.
So my research is into alternative proteins, and one of those been identified is insects. And of the insects, the larvae of the black soldier fly appear to be a key species that will help us to produce alternative protein in a nutshell, to be a more sustainable animal feed and reduce waste.
So has this been around for a while? Kind of how has this research come about? Was it something that was already happening?
Yeah, I could see that the demand for sustainable protein is rising fast. Obviously, we live in a world that's of a size that can produce food for the masses around the globe, but that's limited in terms of how that can be scaled. And traditional livestock can only achieve so much protein, and another way to support our demand for high nutrition could be looking at the insect protein, and that can be reared on like real-world organic waste streams. And the part I'm really interested in is bringing to market efficient laboratory processes to test not only the nutritional value of the larvae, but also looking at the contaminants. And some of those could be pesticides that may have made their way into the larvae from the waste stream that they eat, and it may end up in their protein. So I'm keen to support the growers in the industry to optimize their processes by either selecting efficient and safe organic side streams, or confirming that particular pesticides that may be in the waste stream are metabolized by the larvae and not a concern.
So. Yeah, I was going to ask about food safety, and I guess if we could start off by explaining how this protein is actually harvested, developed, and then, are there any other concerns or things that will have to be considered before this can kind of be a widespread protein source?
Yeah, so there are a number of growers that have started up in Australia. I'm working with two of them, and they're looking at taking waste streams from their local environment to produce high-quality larvae. So they take waste that otherwise would have been going to landfill from agro-industrial processes and rear larvae on them by adding neonates to the larvae as a substrate for them to grow in, and then rearing them to maturity over a few weeks, and they reduce the waste mass and turn it into a high-quality protein that can be harvested and converted into other proteins.
So a question that occurs to me, and I'm sure many of our listeners, Sam, what does it taste like?
To me, I've tasted the larvae, and it doesn't really taste like much at all. The ones I have eaten were microwaved and then put through a peanut roaster to produce a crunchy larvae that's sort of like a chip, I suppose, in a way.
So I guess it'll more depend on what it's seasoned with as to what it ends up tasting like.
Absolutely. So I guess outside of my project is looking at what applications that might go into, whether that's something that's added to an animal feed to enhance the animal production, or potentially into some form that would be for human consumption. So I'm really keen to make sure that anything that happens in that space, we have processes in place to test for food safety.
As far as nutrition goes, how directly does it compare with a traditional protein source? Is it calorie dense in a way your beef or your chicken might be?
Yeah, so it can have really high protein content as well as a good fat or lipid content and profile, which can be manipulated with the diet they're fed. So depending on what they're reared on, we can manipulate the amount of protein or the amount of lipid that is in the final product. And that's something that growers can consider when selecting the substrate that they're going to rear the larvae on.
Yeah, interesting. So are there any particular standouts when it comes to the agricultural waste that is being used as to what quality larvae is produced at the end of it?
Yeah, so the combinations of different waste streams would appear to give the better rearing conditions for the larvae. I guess they're somewhat fussy on variety that they like to eat. So we used a combination. I ended up doing 11 different trials, and that ranged from animal waste products through to fruit and veg from pre-consumer waste.
protein sources in the future. It's going to be, they're very important for human consumption, but there are considerations around environmental, how environmentally friendly protein sources can be, and if current levels are sustainable. What part could this kind of protein source play when it comes to that story?
Yeah, this can play a part in supporting protein production for animal feed. So an example with that would be, you know, soy and fish meal have quite a high environmental cost, and using the black soldierfly larvae, we can convert waste streams that otherwise would have been lost from the food chain, so reclaiming those nutrients and bringing them back into a more circular economy and being more efficient with the way we do our farming.
Yeah, is it a pretty environmental way to get your protein? You know, are there any particular environmental impacts to consider in this process?
So they're said to have lower environmental impact in terms of more efficient, less use of resources such as water. They can be vertically farmed, so can take up quite a small space comparatively to, say, cattle. So to rear the same amount of protein can take quite a lot less environmental impact.
Food safety analyst at the Australian Superintendent's Company and researcher with Adelaide University, Sam Mallard, speaking with Elsie Adamo there. Is this something you would want to snack on, Ryan, from Golf Your Hot? Says, giving maggots a fancy name won't tempt me to eat them. I also had a caller say, eat more pork. We have plenty of pork available if you're after a protein source, and sounds like prices for pork aren't all that flash at the moment. So eat more pork was this caller's message. It is 9 minutes to one.
I don't know what I'm going to find here.
Discover a vault filled with all the cases, all the crime.
What's dangerous?
You don't trust anyone.
Shetland, The Capture, Treasure and Dirt, and so many more.
You can't say I didn't warn you.
Stream now on ABC iView.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, go from something that doesn't sound terribly appetising, like maggots, to sweet, ripe, juicy strawberries. Only they are no longer only red. A novel new white and blush variety is now being grown commercially in Australia. Their genetics have been developed both here and abroad, but you may have to wait to try some as the fruit is still in very short supply. Jennifer Nichols has this very tasty story.
They taste incredible.
In a research patch on Queensland's Sunshine Coast, ripe white strawberries now grow beside traditional reds.
So this is our new blush variety. They're not underripe, they're so sweet, and the inside is completely white.
Dr. Jodie Neal leads Australia's National Strawberry Breeding Program and is explaining the white fruit to growers at a field day.
So what happens is where the sun hits the fruit, the top of it, it colours up, kind of like a peach, when the bottom will always stay white.
From cross-pollination to commercial release, it's the culmination of 7 years of research and on-farm trials.
It's a new specialty variety that is out in stores in the very first time this year.
Still to get an official name, it's the first of several white varieties Dr. Neal has been working on to make it to market.
Yeah, it's newly available for our farmers to grow and our consumers to eat.
Jodie Neal and her team have developed about half of the strawberry varieties grown commercially around Australia.
Production costs obviously are rising, fuel costs, all of this stuff, labour costs.
The focus is on developing hardy, high-yielding, tasty, disease and bruise-resistant fruit that's easy to pick and pack.
We are trying to make sure that our farmers stay sustainable, that they can stay in business.
It's really exciting to keep investing in breeding, and we really encourage consumers to give these new strawberries a go.
Berries Australia CEO Rachel McKenzie says researchers and growers have been eager to offer consumers colour choices in strawberries, just like we get with other fruit.
Well, we all like novelty. We all like something new.
White strawberries, which range from cream to blush, originated from a natural genetic mutation. Rachel McKenzie says they have lower acidity than their red relatives, but are still packed with vitamins C, A, K, and potassium.
They've got a slightly different flavour profile. So I think, you know, we are keen for everyone to give them a try and see if they match their expectations.
Educating consumers that the white fruit is ripe is part of the process.
You know, we look at the way the fruit and vegetables that we eat now have evolved over history. If you never tried any new things, we wouldn't have the products that we have today.
It's been a race to sell white strawberries in Australia. They've been available in some countries for many years. The Australian breadfruit has competition from genetics imported from Japan and the United States. Some white varieties are described as sweeter, like candy. Others have hints of pineapple, pear, vanilla and guava.
So for us, it was a business decision more so than one variety against another or Queensland versus Florida.
Laura Wells is the co-owner of TSL Family Farms at Bellmere near Brisbane and says she can't keep up with supermarket demand for fruit from their 70,000 rose pearl plants. They secured exclusive rights to the variety, which was developed in Florida.
We've only been able to send them through to New South Wales and Victoria currently, and in only a few chosen stores. Coles's experience is that there's just none left on the shelves anywhere. They're an interesting flavour. I wouldn't say that they have a strawberry flavour or aroma. They've got a very subtle, mild and mellow kind of palate. Across the trials on farm tasting, people are saying similar to a like melon honeydew, some are saying pear. More tropical-y kind of flavour, but very mild and delicate. The challenge is trying to get the proper research around, is it returning customer or is it just a frenzy kind of new niche thing? So we're going to work hard this year and next year to try and establish that.
Brendan Hoyle at Ashburn Farms in the Glasshouse Mountains is one of the growers in Queensland and Perth to trial the new Australian bred white strawberries. He has about 100 of the plants.
And they're looking promising. The flavour is amazing.
How do you know when to pick it?
Yeah, it's quite difficult. I think you kind of get your head around it, you know, once you've seen a few of them. They just need to just start turning just very slightly blush and then you know that they're good to go. And you don't want to leave them too long because then the flavour changes again. But yeah, certainly very interesting and very unique.
Wholesale nurseries are still multiplying them for growers. They're all in short supply.
A little bit harder to grow than the red just because it's obviously a genetic difference in the plant. But they are very promising. You know, I think that there's certainly be a market for them.
Back at the Marucci Research Centre, Jody Neal is feeling positive about the future, despite the many challenges facing the industry.
It is honestly what keeps me going. It is the best part of my job. Seeing our varieties that we've developed here in Australia, grown by our Australian farmers and being enjoyed by our consumers, the industry impact, being able to keep our farmers in business, all of that is just so rewarding. I love it.
Sounds delicious too, all those different types of flavours. I would love to try those a lot more than trying maggots. I would definitely say that. That was Dr. Jody Neal, who leads the Australian Strawberry Breeding Program. And you can see what the different white varieties look like in our story online on the ABC Rural website. That's abc.net.au/rural. Before I let you go, I just wanted to let you know about the Livestock SA Biosecurity Farmer of the Year Award for 2026. Now, the award recognises producers, groups and organisations who are leading the way in protecting South Australia's livestock industry through outstanding biosecurity practices. The award is in its fourth year and it celebrates those in the red meat and wool sectors who are demonstrating a strong commitment to safeguarding animal health, welfare and the long-term sustainability of the industry. And even better, you get a $1,000 cash prize and you automatically are nominated for the 2026 Australian Biosecurity Awards as well. So nominations can be submitted in writing or via video and must address the award criteria, and that's all available on the Livestock SA website. And the award will be presented at the 2026 Livestock SA Industry Dinner on the 19th of November, and nominations close on the 10th of September this year. So if you're keen, you've got a little over a month to get your nominations in. That's all we have time for in the program today. As I mentioned, you can go online to abc.net.au/rural. Also, if you would like to catch up on any programs you might have missed, you can just search for SA Country Hour, where you find your podcasts, and you should be able to hear any of the programs from the last year or so. I think it goes back a little further, but definitely from the last year or so of what we've been running in the Country Hour. But for now, I will leave you with news, and then it's off to the afternoon's program with Joe Laverty. It is coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for news.
Don't fight the static. Hear ABC local radio crystal clear on the ABC Listen app. Download now.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.